Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, a look back at 10 years of Creative Fresno. The nonprofit group began in 2004 and has been working to boost the creative economy in the Valley. We'll find out what's changed and what hasn't. We'll also find out how you can help those most affected by the drought with the new Central Valley Drought Relief Fund launched by the Fresno Regional Foundation. But first, a talk with a journalism legend. This summer will mark the 40th anniversary of the resignation of President Richard Nixon, the final act in a sad chapter in American history that began with the bungled break-in at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C. Two young reporters for the Washington Post broke the story that led to the demise of the Nixon administration, Bob Woodward and our next guest, Carl Bernstein. Their work resulted in a Pulitzer Prize for the Post in 1973, as well as the book and later the film All the President's Men. Together, they helped redefine investigative journalism for a new generation. Carl Bernstein will visit Fresno Wednesday to speak as part of the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series at the William Saroyan Theater. He'll talk about the increasing dysfunction of America's governmental institutions and the media landscape in a talk titled The System Can Work. Mr. Bernstein, welcome to Valley Edition.
Good to be with you.
I want to start out by looking back some years, and in fact, looking back 9 years ago when Mark Felt's family disclosed his identity as your source, Deep Throat. At the time, you wrote that if the Watergate scandal happened today, the stories would be published in the media, but you weren't certain that they would have the same impact in the public, in government, in changes to the system that we saw in the 1970s following Watergate. Why is that, and is that still the case, do you think?
I think we had a functional governmental system, and particularly a Congress, and also we had a different culture, political culture, social culture in the country then. That often I see these days the tremendous criticism of the press, some or much of it justified, about the way we do our job. You know, good reporting is really nothing more than the best obtainable version of the truth, which is a simple phrase, but a difficult concept to accomplish. And I think there's a tremendous amount of great reporting being done. But I think the way that that reporting is being received today, increasingly, viewers, readers of the web, of newspapers, of print, information is looked at too often through an ideological lens, so that many, many people, and many more than at the time of Watergate, have very little interest in the best obtainable version of the truth, but rather are looking for information to reinforce their already held beliefs, prejudices, ideologies, religious notions, etc., etc. They're not interested, too many of them, in the best obtainable version of the truth. They're looking for ammunition to fight cultural war. And we've had cultural war now for upwards of 30 years in this country, and it's been debilitating and it's undermined the effectiveness of our system, particularly in the Congress of the United States, which is a totally dysfunctional institution. But also, I think we have to look at our citizenry, too. We can't just blame everything on the politicians and the media, because the people have an awful lot to do with this equation of not being interested in the truth.
In terms of response to a massive scandal and the reporting of a massive scandal, do you see any parallels between your work in Watergate and the current revelations brought about by Edward Snowden in the NSA spying scandal?
I think that real events occur in their own time, and they need to be considered in their own time. This is 40 years later, and also they're totally apples and oranges in the following way. What we wrote about in Watergate and what Watergate was about was a criminal president of the United States and a criminal presidency, probably unlike anything in our history, certainly unlike anything in our history we know about. And this was not about a break-in. The break-in, as we wrote, was just a small part of a massive campaign of political espionage and sabotage and other criminal acts to undermine the very system of free elections that we have in this country. And as we know now from the Nixon tapes, the extent of the criminality of the President of the United States is breathtaking. People might want to go to on my website, carlbernstein.com. There's or the Washington Post site. Bob and myself wrote a piece on the 40th anniversary of the break-in, explaining how Watergate, in quotes, was infinitely worse, and Nixon was infinitely worse than we had thought at the time we were writing the stories, and even at the time of the resignation. I mean, you listen to some of these tapes. Now you listen to the President of the United States 1 year before Watergate, talking with his aides about some documents in a think tank in Washington at the Brookings Institution. And Nixon says, I don't care what you have to do to get those documents out of there. Firebomb the goddamn place. Break in. Do whatever you have to do. Blow the safe. That's the President of the United States. And what were the papers? They were papers that he thought, and Kissinger, who was standing next to him, his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, that they thought that they could smear Lyndon Johnson, Nixon's predecessor, in such a way that Nixon's conduct of the war in Vietnam would look good compared to Johnson's, if only they could blow the safe in the Brookings Institution and get these documents out of there.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Carl Bernstein. I want to talk about the executive branch. President Obama campaigned on a lot of issues. One of them was transparency. How do you think his administration rates in that area, and how does it compare when it comes to transparency with that of his predecessor, George W. Bush?
I think presidents tend to be pretty lousy about transparency, and some of it justifiable and some of it not justifiable. I think that there's some differences between Obama and Bush in the following way, that Bush took us into a war through false assertion, through claims that were unjustified, not factual, particularly the Vice President of the United States, Cheney, who led a lot of the clamor to go to war and was the person who was out front with statements, along with Rumsfeld and the President of the United States, that just weren't true. I think that the Obama administration and the President has not been that grievous in terms of taking us into a war under false pretenses. That said, I think that like all presidents, and it goes for the Clintons as well, that Obama has obfuscated at times. There are versions of events that if there was real transparency, we would know a lot more about things. But presidents, once they've been in office for a while, somewhat justifiably want to be able to work without every one of their utterances and starts and false starts and back and fro being known to people, and a good deal of that is legitimate. At the same time, when it comes to some aspects of the conduct of the presidency, there does need to be more transparency. And like the predecessor administration's plural, the Obama White House is lousy at it.
I want to turn now to Hillary Clinton. She was the subject of your most recent book, A Woman in Charge. Looks increasingly likely that Mrs. Clinton will seek her party's nomination for president in 2016. How do you think she has changed as a leader? You've followed her career?
I think, first of all, that she's tremendously more comfortable in her own assertive way than she was when she was the first lady, even in, when she was a senator. I think she was in many regards a terrific Secretary of State, a great ambassador around the world for this country. She was not on the inside among the president's chief policymakers in terms of decision making at the highest level. She was much more an implementer as Secretary of State. But I think she's learned a lot. That said, I think also I don't think it's certain yet that she's running. I think the odds are that she'll run, but I think there are also some things that might keep her from running, and we don't know, and nor does she know, I believe, for sure that she's going to run, though there are certainly appearances that would indicate that she is. But she's, you know, she's older and wiser. I don't know, as well as I think she's more enthusiastic, and I think she connects with people better than she did, say, 20 years ago.
Carl Bernstein is our guest on Valley Edition today. I want to turn now to the world of journalism and look at your early career before Watergate, when you were starting out as a journalist. The world has changed so much in that time. When you look back at those years now, how did they prepare you for the career that you had, and how is that, would that be different for a young journalist now today in this new landscape?
Well, my experience was exceptional even then, and I'm writing a memoir about it now. I went to work for a great newspaper in Washington for 5 years between the ages of 16 and 21, and by the time I was 19, I was a reporter at the Washington Star, a great newspaper, the afternoon newspaper, and the people that I learned from and became my teachers at that very young age were absolutely fabulous. They were my teachers. They were my mentors. They recognized things in myself that I probably hadn't recognized myself. And it was a joyous experience. No 16-year-old kid ever had that kind of seat at the table that I can think of almost, from ages 16 to 21 in the capital of the United States during the Kennedy and Johnson years. I went to most of Kennedy's press conferences as a copy boy, running text back to the office, simultaneous text of Kennedy's press conferences. It was the height of the civil rights. You know, this week it's 50 years since the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I covered that summer of 64 some of the horrendous events in the civil rights struggle, in which people were killed, in which crosses were burned, and yet there was this great triumph that resulted in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was 100 years after the Civil War, exactly, my 5 years at the Star. And the Civil War still cast a shadow, particularly in the capital of the United States, where I was born. When I was born in Washington, it was still a Jim Crow town. I went to segregated public schools in the capital of the United States till Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 when I was in the sixth grade. So it was a different country, but I come back to this idea of the best obtainable version of the truth. That's what these great reporters at the Star and editors taught me journalism and reporting was really about, the best obtainable version of the truth. And that, you know, that means something about going to one source after another and continuing to be perseverant and respecting the people you're covering and not going into a meeting or a press conference or anything else and shouting a couple questions and then running out of the place. It means trying to dig deep. And so I learned that. And it later, I think, is one of the reasons that we were able, and Bob learned it too, actually, also through some great mentors that he had. And we were lucky enough to have had that kind of mentoring an understanding of what reporters do, that when this extraordinary story and opportunity was there and we were lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, we knew to some extent what to do.
Your former editor at the Post, Ben Bradley, was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom late last year. How would you characterize your relationship with him, and what makes a great editor in your view?
Well, Bradley, I think, is the greatest editor of his time, because he had about 18 different ways of saying, go out there and get the damn story. That's your job. And get it right and get it in context and keep working at it and use common sense. And don't think you're better than anybody else in terms of having some kind of license to be fast and footloose or untruthful in any way. You got to go through all the steps that are required to get the best obtainable version of the truth. He was a great motivator with a great understanding of what the news is, almost a sixth sense about a great story. And he knew how to push his reporters. And also, the newsroom that he ran was hardly free of tension or competition. He used to call it creative tension, creative competition. But you could see the results in the paper that he produced. And also, he was a very inventive editor. It was Bradley who invented the style coverage that we now take for granted in newspapers and daily journalism. He took what had been the women's and social news section of the paper and combined it and did away with the women's section, combined social coverage with cultural coverage, and created what was called the style section, that we now take for granted as part of coverage of news in this country and around the world. He did it. He thought outside the box. And that's the other thing that I think great editors and great reporters do, that they're thinking a little bit outside the box. They're not bound by conventional wisdom. And also, Bradley was indefatigable.
Before we go, I want to look forward to the future of journalism. There's been endless talk over the last decade or so about just that very topic. Last year, we saw the Graham family sell its stake in the Washington Post to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. In the last few months, we've seen Ezra Klein and Nate Silver launch their own projects away from the traditional papers. Do you think this is a good thing for journalism, those projects in particular? And
absolutely, I do. I think there's great reporting being done in many different venues. I think the web is a great platform for reporting. I ran in the late 1990s the first political news website called Voter.com. I was the editor of it for about 3 years. I believe in the web. I also believe that the most important thing that needs to be conveyed and continued in journalism are the high standards about the best obtainable version of the truth. I sound like a broken record, that come from good reporting, and that there is an awful lot of it out there, and it's too easy to dismiss it. Look at the story of the pedophile priest in the Catholic Church that was broken by the Boston Globe. I mean, incredible series of stories of huge consequence, great reporting. Take a look. I was last year the judge, one of the judges of the announcements, reading the citations of the Polk Awards, which next to the Pulitzers are probably the most important of the journalism awards. That year, as this year, the Polk Awards, the 15 award winners, each of them, great stories in foreign news, local news, political news, cultural news, war news, investigative reporting. I mean, fabulous reporting. So there's no shortage of great reporting. I keep coming to this same point, that it's about how news is perceived. If people are going to think that they are going to get the best obtainable version of the truth by switching between cable news channels, and particularly the committed ones, Fox and MSNBC, they're fooling themselves. But I don't think they're fooling themselves because I don't think those people who are glued to those channels as a basic source of their news have much interest in much beyond what they already believe and how news breaking news events fit into their ideological and political and religious beliefs to reinforce them. So I think we've got a real problem, much more than we have a problem in the production and coverage of involving great reporting, of how that great reporting is received.
One last question. You said you're working on your memoir. What?
It's a memoir only about those 5 years growing up in this great newspaper that competed and beat usually the Washington Post.
What do you want to be most remembered for?
Oh, being my kid's father, I guess. But outside of that, obviously, you know, I guess the Watergate reporting. But you know, being a good reporter, that's really the most important thing.
Our guest today on Valley Edition has been Carl Bernstein. He is speaking in Fresno at the William Saroyan Theater on Wednesday morning. He will give a talk that is called The System Can Work, addressing the increasing dysfunction of America's governmental institutions and the media landscape. Mr. Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be there, and I look forward to being in Fresno. Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk about the 10th anniversary of a local organization that's dedicated to making Fresno and the Valley a more interesting place to live. The group is called Creative Fresno. They'll join us in a moment, right after this.
Valley Public Radio's 30th annual wine tasting is Sunday, May 4th. Hi, I'm Kurt Zumwalt of Zumwalt Construction, inviting you to join us at the Riverside Lester Estate in Fresno. Vintner coordinator Barry Bennett's theme is Mastering the Art of Wine, and his selections are sure to please your palate. Enjoy hors d'oeuvres prepared by Elbow Room chef Roy Harlan, plus live music and a silent auction. Tickets for Sunday, May 4th are available online at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Back in the mid-1980s, writer and urban planner Charles Landry was the first to describe how creativity, and specifically those involved in creative professions, can transform a city, something he called the Creative Cities Movement. Later in the early 2000s, writers like Richard Florida went on to detail a theory about how a new creative class of designers, artists, and entrepreneurs wield a profound positive economic impact on the culture of their cities. The implication was clear. Those cities that embrace the culture and values of those in this new creative class will thrive, and those that don't will see their economies stagnate and decline. With those thoughts in mind, as well as the Valley's chronic double-digit unemployment and the exodus of college-educated professionals, some termed the brain drain, in 2004, a group of local individuals came together to form something called Creative Fresno. Creative Fresno is now celebrating its 10th anniversary with an event looking back at the progress and pitfalls of the last decade on April 22nd called the Meeting of the Minds. And joining us now are two board members from the group. Both have ties back to the organization's earliest days. We'd like to welcome to Valley Edition Suzanne Bertz-Rosa and Andy Hansen-Smith. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, Joe.
Thank you,
How's
Joe.
How's it going?
We're glad to be here.
Very pleased to have you on the program. Looking back to 2004, when you started Creative Fresno, what was the initial idea? What did you hope to accomplish initially when you started out?
Well, I don't think either one of us actually started Creative Fresno. We did get involved in the early days. I remember the first meeting at the Metropolitan Museum, which is now gone, which breaks my heart. But it was really exciting because I had come back to Fresno after being gone for 12 years, and I thought I was the only person like me in Fresno. And when everyone got together and talked about how they wanted to improve this place and make it a place for creative professionals and knowledge workers, I was like, cool, this sounds like a lot of fun. Let's do this.
And when you said the only person like you, what do you mean by that?
I think that I was a technology worker, and so I worked – a lot of my clients were out of the area at the time, so I worked remotely, and I had my laptop wherever I went. And I'm a graphic designer, so I do a lot of design now. So I just – I felt like I was in the minority, and I think that what we've learned is there was a lot of other people who were like me. And I was just getting into filmmaking at the time, and I thought – you know, there's only the people who make TV commercials and nobody else. But also through the Creative Fresno, we've learned that there are lots of filmmakers here and all different levels and areas of interest.
That's one of the things I think the group has done is connect a lot of people who are in some way isolated. This the geographic nature of the space, we're such a spread out area here in Central California. Andy, when you think back 10 years ago when you first got involved with Creative Fresno, I know that you were there in the early days. What was the original vision like from your recollection?
I came in for a slightly different reason than Suzanne. I'm not very creative at anything. I was more interested in the brain drain of my then two young daughters. And I was afraid, you know, they weren't going to see Fresno as a place to stay and they were going to leave. So I said, what can I do to help? And I saw an article in the Fresno Bee that Suzanne was actually a photo in from that event. And I got excited about that. So I've been kind of working, trying to get, you know, prevent that brain drain from our colleges or from our high schools.
How was it initially received, Creative Fresno?
There was a lot of people at that initial meeting in 2004. And right around that same time, I'd started this listserv called MindHub. And so it seemed like this natural way because they were all talking about how to communicate with each other. This is, of course, before social media. There was probably 200 people there. So Creative Fresno really is about placemaking and using creativity to create a sense of place. And it was great to meet all of the other folks who were willing to do things like that.
One of the biggest things that your organization did in the early days was the Creative Economy Council report that was commissioned by the mayor of Fresno, the then mayor of Fresno, Alan Autry. And this panel eventually wound up issuing this report called Making the Grass Greener, Ways to Attract and Retain Knowledge Workers. And that goes to what Andy is talking about, this brain drain. Did you have any idea what you were getting involved in when you started out on that project?
No, not at all. And it was at first it was separate from Creative Fresno, although most of the members had some involvement with Creative Fresno. And so when that group disbanded, it made sense for Creative Fresno to kind of take it over. And I look back now at the recommendations made in 2005, actually published in 2006, and think, we were so naive. We were so hopeful.
And plus the recession kicked in a couple years later. That did not help situations.
Some of our recommendations at the time have changed because of our better understanding, certainly Creative Fresno's better understanding of how policy works and also changing technology as in changing the recommendations as well. But a lot – when looking back, I'm working on the report card right now. Looking back, a lot has been accomplished.
Creative Fresno has issued periodic report cards on the city's performance in implementing these strategies or things the city has done that are contrary to those strategies. How do you think the city has done on some of those things?
I think in some ways the city has done an amazing job. You know, there is the outdoor dining ordinance that was just a thought back in 2005, and now it's just passed. Sure, it takes a while. That's one of the things we've learned is policymaking takes a while. The focus on downtown and infill is all great. Smart growth, that's been considered. So a lot of things have been considered. I think that one of the areas where we still need some help is certainly in green space. But I know that there are a lot of green space projects on the horizon. So that's something that's really exciting.
We talked about maybe the canals being a linear parkway, and I think that's still in the works. You know, there's some liability issues to work out there, but that would be an easy way to bring a lot of green space quickly.
So that's part of the master urban parkway. And I've been talking to those folks as part of this report card. So hopefully we'll have an update when that report card's published.
You said that some of the areas have changed. What are some of those that have changed, do you think?
I think probably the biggest thing that's changed that I think Creative Fresno really impacted is that everyone used to say there's nothing to do here. So one of the first things that Creative Fresno did was start Blender. So we had monthly kind of happy hour get-togethers so we could meet other creative professionals and knowledge workers. And we found out there was a lot more going on than we knew about. So I don't think unless you're living in a hole, you're not going to say there's nothing going on here. In fact, there's so much going on. I have a hard time making a decision.
Yeah, I'm turning down things every day that would be great to go to.
Looking at the organization, you're not just talking about policy wonk type stuff. You're also doing a lot of activities and other projects. Andy, what are you most proud of with Creative Fresno? I immediately think of the murals that have bloomed in downtown Fresno in large part thanks to Creative Fresno. What are you most proud of that the organization has done?
That is definitely the thing that people see, I think, are the murals. You know, you can visualize that. Just go downtown. I think we have 12 murals up. We have our 13th going up across from the Warner's Theater at the CVS, and that's a great, beautiful mural. People should check that one out. We also do an event called Pecha Kucha, which is very interesting. It's kind of like a PowerPoint thing, but more exciting, and it's in a bar, so it's social and fun, and that brings a different crowd of people that go to a lot of our other events. So it's interesting who comes out for what items.
And what are you most proud of, Suzanne?
I think the change in attitude. I think when we first got here, the mindset was really, really tough. It was, you know, Fresno, it does suck here, and there were T-shirts about it, and it was like, yeah, but if you don't do anything about it, it's going to continue to be that way. So I think that people have really changed their mindset to understand that they're responsible for the community that they live in. And if they want to live in a cool, interesting place, they need to be cool and interesting people, and they need to make cool and interesting events.
Looking back at successes, what are also some of the challenges, things that are still out there on the agenda that maybe haven't been crossed off the list? Done a great job on murals, the mixers, bringing the community together and shaping dialogue. But what are some of the unfinished items that are out there?
I think that one of our projects is the boomerang strategy, where we're bringing back folks, entrepreneurs, and creative professionals and knowledge workers, and hope to jumpstart the economy. So part of the economy is bringing in people who have strong workforce skills. And part of the equation is raising up workforce skills in order to meet the jobs that are available. We're not attacking that second part, but it's probably it's one of the core issues in order to making Fresno have a vibrant economy.
Interesting indeed to follow this over the last decade and seeing where it will go in the future. Again, it's the Meeting of the Minds, an event taking place April 22nd at Frank's Place in downtown Fresno, celebrating the 10th anniversary of Creative Fresno, a local nonprofit organization that is dedicated to making Fresno a livable community for all, but specifically those involved in creative professions and bolstering that sector in the local economy. Tell us briefly before we go about this event, how can people find out about it and what's on the agenda?
You can find out about the event on our Facebook page. It's Creative Fresno. Or you can go to our website, creativefresno.com. On the agenda is, well, certainly free appetizers, no host bar, and a conversation with a lot of interesting people, including a presentation by Dr. Tim Stearns on whether there is a creative ecosystem here, and a discussion by Mayor Ashley Swearingen, looking back and looking forward.
Yes, indeed. We're looking forward to it again. It's called The Meeting of the Minds, Creative Fresno's 10th anniversary. Look back and look forward at Frank's Place in downtown Fresno, 6 p.m. And again, creativefresno.com. Suzanne Burtz-Rosa and Andy Hansen-Smith, longtime members of the board of the organization, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. It was our pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Over the past few months, we've been documenting the real-life stories of California's historic drought in our series, Voices of the Drought. We've talked to farmers, farm workers, fish and wildlife experts, snow surveyors, and more. Many people are asking, what can they do? And while reducing water use is one obvious answer, another is philanthropy, helping those who will be hardest hit this summer and fall. Joining us now is Dan DeSantis. He's the president and CEO of the Fresno Regional Foundation to tell us more about a project along those lines. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You've launched something called the Central Valley Drought Relief Fund. How did this come about?
Well, a lot of people realize that we have an imminent crisis here in the Central Valley that could go on for quite some time, and a lot of people are going to need a lot of help. And maybe a couple of months ago, maybe a little longer, a number of groups, individuals, and organizations have come together to form a coalition. These include the local food bank, the Salvation Army, the Fresno Economic Opportunities Commission, the USDA Rural Development Group, Catholic Charities, Poverello House, Hands On, and many others have come together and says, what can we do? So they've begun to meet. They're very organized. They know what they're doing. They are very familiar with the communities they want to serve. Certainly they want to serve the entire Central Valley, but they're focusing on the west side. And they realize that it's going to take money. And so they called upon the Fresno Regional Foundation. That's something we do as a community foundation. We help raise money through philanthropy, which is often very easy to do. And the hard part is giving it away and making sure the money that we give back to the community is used wisely. And so we're going to partner with them. They ask if we would create the fund. We have created a fund called the Drought Relief Fund. Anybody can donate money to it. When you send money to it, make the check out to the Fresno Regional Foundation and on the memo line put for drought relief. The fund was opened with a very generous donation from an anonymous donor. So we're pleased to have the fund. It exists now, and there is money in it. And I'm very pleased to say that Granville Homes has pledged $500,000 to the fund. They're telling us that they're going to give us $100,000 a month for the next 5 months to put $500,000 in that fund. And what we're hoping to do as a community foundation is reach out to the community, to everybody in the community, all levels. Everybody, every man, woman, and child who has an extra dollar to send, we'd love to help them invest that in the community, and including individuals who have more to give, we'd love to see that, and businesses and organizations, we'd like to see them step up generously to put money into this fund that can all of it will be given back to the community.
So you're going to be working directly with those charities that provide the services in the community. Is there an idea of how great the need is, of how much money you need to raise, or is it just an open-ended, as much as we can?
At this point, it's open-ended, and it's going to be big. Now, you say we're going to be working with them. That's not what the Community Foundation will be doing. They're very organized, as I said, and what they've put together is an advisory committee, and the advisory committee is forming different areas that they want to focus on. They're going to have a little group focusing on food services. They're going to have a group focusing on housing. They'll have a group focusing on utilities, on employment, and then one that they're calling essential human services. It can do anything as much as giving diapers, providing diapers for families in need. But each of those focus areas will study the various communities and the various needs, and they'll say, this is what we need. That information will go to a 5-person advisory committee, and so far we have 4 of the 5 people identified who are going to serve on that. One of them is Judge Anthony Ishii. The other is a local banker, Dennis Woods, Stacy Sablon, an attorney and a community leader out on the west side. Derek Hibashi from Granville Homes will serve on it, and they're looking to identify the 5th person on it. Hopefully they're trying to find a local farmer who can serve on that committee. That advisory committee will digest the information and the requests that they're receiving from their focus groups, and with that, they will come to the foundation and say, here's where we want you to disperse money, and our board will act on their recommendations.
The Fresno Regional Foundation does a lot of great work in areas of philanthropy, a lot of different programs and funds that you have. Is there any precedent for something quite like this? This really is – you're almost treating it like a natural disaster, a hurricane, earthquake type thing. Have you taken inspiration from some of those types of responses in other communities, or are there other things that have happened here in the Valley that you're building on?
You know, inspiration is a good word for this. The foundation has been around nearly 50 years. We were created in 1965, and over those decades, you know, there's been many crises. I've been with the foundation over 9 years, and I've seen the freeze, and I've seen other different types of things. And I see the community try and respond. You know, they do the best they can, but there's never really been a focal point. And so we said, this is something that we should be doing. And yes, we've seen other community foundations do similar things. So we're stepping up, and this is our drought relief fund. And we'll learn from it. We'll do the best we can. We're confident we can be good stewards of the money. But ideally, we'd love to create a permanent community crisis fund that anybody can leave money to during a crisis. People can leave money in their legacy gifts, in their wills, and say, here, I want this to go to the crisis fund, knowing that whatever the next crisis be, whether it's a drought or a freeze or a flood or a fire, that there's somebody there already ready to help.
What's the response been like so far from the community?
Well, we haven't got the word out. This is our first public announcement, I believe, of what we're going to do. I've done a little newsletter. I've had some expressions of interest from some corporations, which I'm thrilled with, and some high net worth individuals have made some inquiries. But in all candor, we haven't got that first check in yet, and that's why I'm here today reaching out to the community.
Dan, in so many cases, we've seen the nation respond to big events, hurricanes, floods, fires. There are often big telethons and things that raise a lot of money. And then after the fact, sometimes people say, where did that money really go? Right. What's your process for tracking this money that you're asking people to donate and making sure that it's used effectively? What's the follow-up there?
Well, the Fresno Regional Foundation, as I've said, has been around since 1966, and we have almost 50 years of experience of being good stewards over the donated dollar. We have hundreds of different funds. We have donor-advised funds, scholarship funds, field of interest funds. Each fund has its own identity, its own management, its own bookkeeping, and we account for every single penny. We are audited every single year. We have the highest rating from the Council of Foundations, and so anybody can come in at any time and say, I want to know about this fund. I should also mention on the side that to run an organization like ours, it costs money, and we generally ask for an administrative contribution, a euphemism for fees for managing funds, and our board of directors has waived all fees on this fund so that it's their contribution to the drought relief effort. And so every dollar that's coming in is going to be going straight out to help the people in need.
And you'll also be tracking the use of those funds.
Absolutely. Back to this coalition, they will get a record of every single donation made. It may be from the individual, the business, or an anonymous donor. And every single disbursement will be recorded and provided back to the coalition.
So how can people help if they want to be involved? Maybe they want to think about strategic giving and planning their philanthropy and are interested in learning more about this. What's the next step for somebody who has an interest, whether it's donating $50 or $500,000.
Yeah. Anybody who wants to make a donation now and said, I believe in this purpose, this cause, and I want to support it, can write a check to the Fresno Regional Foundation and just put on the check for the Drought Relief Fund. If they have questions about it, some people of high net worth want to give more complicated giving, gifts of appreciated assets, gifts of stock, or actually even real estate. We're in a position to accept those gifts. A gift of stock. If you bought stock and it's gone up, we wouldn't. And you decide you want to make a donation, we wouldn't expect you to go out and sell that stock and pay taxes on your gains. Donate the stock to the foundation. We sell it, and no taxes are paid on it, and all the money will go into the fund. If they want to send a check in, it's a Fresno Regional Foundation. Our address is 5250 North Palm Avenue, Suite 424, Fresno 93704. If you have any questions, give us a call. It's area code 559-226-5600, or you can email us. You can email me at dan@fresnoregfoundation.org. That's all one word, FresnoRegFoundation.org.
Can people give online as well?
Yes, you can. Go to our website, www.fresnoregfoundation.org.
We've been talking with Dan DeSantis. He is the president and CEO of the Fresno Regional Foundation, announcing today the creation of the Central Valley Drought Relief Fund. It is an effort to provide support for community organizations that are directly serving those most impacted by the drought here in Central California. It's already off to a great start with a very significant initial gift and an additional $500,000 pledge from local developer Granville Homes. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Creative Fresno isn't the only organization throwing a 10th anniversary event this month. Fresno Filmworks is celebrating the 10th anniversary of their film festival, taking place April 25th through 27th at Fresno's Tower Theater. John Moses of Fresno Filmworks joins us today. John, welcome to Valley Edition.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me here.
10 years of showing film in a film festival in Fresno. Congratulations.
Right. And actually 12 years if you count all of our programming. But in our second year, we started the festival. And this is, as you say, our 10th year. We're excited. We've got some great films again this year for 3 days at the Tower Theater.
What is What can people look forward to this year with the festival?
Well, we always try to have quite a mix. And we're opening with a family drama from Japan called Like Father, Like Son, a very sensitive, moving domestic drama with two wonderful child actors in it, as well as some very famous Japanese performers as well. And it is going to open the festival. We'll have a champagne reception afterward. And so that's the night that most people do come out, and then they come back for the rest of the weekend. We introduce our whole programming to them that night.
So what is the programming like for the festival? How does it run?
Well, it runs Friday night from 7 o'clock for the evening show, and then we've got three programs on Saturday and three more on Sunday. Both days we open with a shorts program of short films under 30 minutes that have been submitted to us from all over the world, and so we've selected the best, and they keep getting better each year. We get more and more submissions. Then we've got another feature, late afternoon, and building towards an evening film for Saturday and Sunday night. We've got documentaries. Finding Vivian Maier is an American documentary that talks about the discovery of this new street photographer that was found just within the last 3 or 4 years, and just, you know, highlighting her marvelous work that was hidden away for years and years. And it's more than just highlighting her photography, as great as that would be, but it also is discovering what motivated her through her life and what may have motivated hiding away her photographs. She had thousands of rolls of film that were never developed and just turned out to be marvelous work. So that's another highlight of the festival.
Has the change in the film industry from film to digital projection, has that been a challenge for Filmworks, and what does that mean for something like the film festival?
Well, it hasn't. I mean, it has been a challenge for Filmworks in general because we are seeing a shift away from 35 millimeter, which we historically have shown since 2002 at the Tower Theater. And now we're getting only about one or two 35 millimeter prints a year. So most of our screenings are now in Blu-ray digital projection, which is quite good, but we're looking ahead to a conversion to the DCP, the high definition, the true high definition cinematic experience. So we're looking at ways to fund that kind of conversion. But for festivals, most of those films are going to come digitally anyway in Blu-ray or sometimes even DVD for the shorts. So we haven't been we haven't lost anything that we wanted to get for this year's festival. Everything that we went out for and said, you know, we'd like to have this feature or that short, we've been able to get.
How do you go about selecting the films? What is that process like? Because I understand you also have to look at what the commercial theaters, commercial houses in the area are playing or have played,
right,
and
right.
distributors. And mm-hmm. this seems complex trying to navigate the industry.
You know, it does get rather complex. We do look at what the commercial theaters are playing. And so, you know, something like Grand Budapest Hotel, you know, it's a wonderful independent film, but, you know, it's got, you know, major prominence. And so it's been playing at the commercial theaters locally. And that's the kind of film we would not want to try to compete with. We want to add to the choices that people can have in the area. So we look at smaller distributors. Sometimes it might be a film that is relatively prominent in other larger markets and may be released by Sony Classics, IFC. So they're larger films, but they still aren't coming here. And so we'll look to those and make sure that we have opportunity to bring them to Fresno. The festival often becomes not so much a springboard for features that haven't gotten theatrical release yet, but gives us the opportunity weekend out of a year to bring in five more films that haven't made it to the area. So some of them are just opening, like Finding Vivian Maier is just open. The Rocket, a wonderful kind of family drama from Australia and Laos, just opened in theaters. It's a fable, rite of passage type film of a young Laotian boy who's trying to overcome what is perceived as the bad luck omen of his birth for his family. And it's a kind of triumphant, very heartwarming story by film's end.
What do you think is the advantage, the benefit, the appeal of the film festival format versus just the regular releases, or even you were talking about, you know, people have so many options today. They can go to IFC. They have all the Netflix things they can get. Why is the film festival format still relevant today, do you think?
Well, it's relevant because it brings these everyone who's an art lover, film art lover, together. I mean, it really creates this community which we've enjoyed contributing to and seen over all of these years. I mean, we have that feeling on the monthly series where everyone sees their friends and, you know, chats about the film afterward. That's just intensified for our festival. You know, people may, you know, we have many people who go to all seven programs, maybe at least five. And so they're hanging around the Tower District and catching a quick bite to eat, coming back for another film. And so that that environment of just sheer pleasure in art films just permeates the theater and the Tower District.
What would be your personal pick? What are you personally looking forward to? Taking off your official Filmworks hat now,
well,
and
just
being a film fan.
I'm just going to, I guess, I'll talk about, since I like father, like
they're
son.
They're all your favorite
they're
children.
They're all my favorites. Yeah. But I'm going to choose now Omar, the Saturday night evening film, which is another one of those unique films that you know, do not come to the multiplex commercial theaters. It's a film that's from Palestine, and it certainly brings the political realities, and it could be described as a political thriller quite accurately. But it's also a love story, and a kind of tragic love story. So that it has those universal dimensions of betrayal, almost has dimensions of Shakespearean tragedy by film's end. That you know, has great universal appeal. And then we finish with this wonderful dramatic comedy called Le Weekend, where a couple who are celebrating their 30th wedding anniversary have gone back to the location of their honeymoon in Paris. And so it's kind of like the Linklaters Before series that he's had over the years, except an older generation. And maybe the writing for the screenplay is just a little tighter and a little darker, I guess. But it's a wonderful way to end the festival on Sunday night, Le Weekend.
Again, we're talking with John Moses of Fresno Filmworks, presenting the 10th Annual Fresno Film Festival, celebrating international film here in Fresno, April 25th through 27th at the historic Tower Theater in Fresno's Tower District. If people want more information, want to get tickets, what can they do?
Well, they can go online. We've got all the ticketing information at our website, fresnofilmworks.org, and ticket prices are $10 regular admission for all the programs, $8 student senior. Weekend passes for all seven programs, just $45. You can pay through PayPal right off the website, or stop by the Tower Theater box office.
We certainly wish you the best with the film festival, again celebrating one decade this year in Fresno. John Moses of Fresno Filmworks, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Joe.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to hear your comments. You can send us an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. on the web at chcf.org.